This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Bianculli, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. This election year has been filled with surprising dramatic twists, but we're going to look back on an election year with shocking twists, 1968. That year, a sitting president withdrew from his re-election bid, the nation's greatest civil rights leader was killed, riots swept through American cities, and an assassin shot and killed Robert Kennedy, a man many saw as a transformational leader for a divided nation. Our guest, Larry Tai, has a new book about Robert Kennedy, often remembered as a presidential candidate who stood for racial healing, fighting poverty, and ending an unpopular war. Early in his career, though, Kennedy was a hard-edged anti-communist who worked for red-baiting Senator Joe McCarthy. He authorized the wiretapping of Martin Luther King, supported American intervention in Vietnam, and showed he could be a cunning, even ruthless political operative. Tai was interested in understanding the journey that changed Kennedy's outlook. In researching the book, he was given access to Kennedy papers never seen by other scholars, and did lengthy interviews with intimates of Kennedy, including his widow, Ethel. Larry Tai is an award-winning journalist who's written several other books, and now runs a training program for medical journalists. Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies spoke to Tai about his new book, Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon, last Tuesday.
Well, Larry Tai, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, you can't understand Bobby Kennedy or any Kennedy without knowing a bit about their father, Joe Kennedy, who was a huge figure in the 20th century, but a lot of our listeners probably don't know much about him. Tell just us a bit about Joe Kennedy, the patriarch's accomplishments and his character.
Joe Kennedy was an extraordinary guy. He was the son of Irish immigrants, grew up in East Boston, and went on at a very young age to start a lot of very successful businesses. And he went to Washington a couple times for different jobs, but the one that he liked best, that Franklin Roosevelt appointed him to, was as ambassador to Great Britain. He went in with great fanfare and great hope, and he crashed and burned while he was there by being quite honest with newspapers in terms of his believing at that moment in history that we ought to be appeasing rather than standing up to Adolf Hitler.
Joe Kennedy had big ambitions for his sons. What was dinner at the Kennedy household like?
So Joe Kennedy had big ambitions, as you said, for himself. Initially, he wanted to be president. He never hid that fact. And when it was clear that wouldn't happen, he tried to encourage his sons at the dinner table and everywhere else to think about things that were important in the world. So instead of just relaxing and having dinner, it was a quiz in current events. It was speaking foreign languages at the dinner table. It was anything that he thought of as self-improvement that would gear his kids up to think of themselves as able to do anything and, in fact, to be able to do anything. So it was partly trying to make them smarter, and it was partly trying to have no limits to their ambitions for themselves and for Joe Kennedy's family.
The eldest son was Joe Kennedy Jr., who might have done great things but was killed in a bombing mission in World War II. The next was John F. Kennedy, Jack Kennedy, who later became president. Bobby, he went to some of the best schools. What kind of student was he like? I mean, he wasn't the sort of easy charmer that his brother was, right?
He was nothing ever came especially easy to Bobby. He was an okay student, but not a great one. And that was at the various prep schools that he went to, the last of which was Milton Academy. And that was also at Harvard University. Academics clearly was something he could do well enough. But when we see the actual grades that he got in his various schools, that was all he did was well enough. That was true in prep school. It was true in college. And it continued on through law school at the University of Virginia, where he was solidly in the middle of his class.
Not a big guy, 5'9", but got into fistfights.
He was a ferocious guy. He never wanted to back down. It was part of the sense that he was a Kennedy, that he was tougher than he looked, and that he was going to prove it to people. When he'd be somewhere with his younger brother, Ted, who was actually bigger than him, it was Bobby who would stand up and challenge whoever it was, whether it was on the football field or in a bar, to fight him. He was tougher than he looked, and that he was darn well going to show it to anybody who challenged him, his family, Irish Catholics, just about anybody else. He took offense at just about everything.
People who remember Bobby Kennedy as a great American progressive and a champion of civil rights and an opponent of the Vietnam War would be surprised at what he did in his younger years, including working for Wisconsin Senator Joe McCarthy, who in the 1950s was the famous red baiter who made accusations he couldn't substantiate, damaged the lives and careers of so many people. Let's talk a bit about that part of Bobby Kennedy's life. How did he know Joe McCarthy, the senator?
He knew Joe McCarthy because Joe Kennedy knew Joe McCarthy. They were pals. When Joe McCarthy would come through Palm Beach, he would stop off at the Kennedys. He would have a drink and a conversation with Joe. And it was natural when Bobby was finishing up with his law school and his early jobs and looking for how to launch a career, it was natural for Joe Kennedy to offer guidance and for Bobby to take it. And that guidance was, go to work for my pal, Joe McCarthy.
Who was making a name for himself, finding communists everywhere in the government. What kind of work did Bobby Kennedy do for McCarthy's permanent subcommittee on investigations?
He did some of the best investigations that McCarthy ever did, the ones that stood up to scrutiny. He took on, for instance, an investigation at the time we were in the war in Korea, why our allies were shipping not just supplies, but even shipping troops to our enemies. And he asked the tough questions that the British didn't like our asking, that other allies like the Greeks didn't like, and that Joe McCarthy did like. So he was doing work involved with an anti-communist cause that Bobby very much believed in, but he was doing much more solid and much less of the witch hunt kind of investigations that Joe McCarthy was known for and that brought down McCarthy.
Did he believe in McCarthy's intense hatred and, let's be honest, paranoia about the influence of communism in American society?
He absolutely believed in that. He said that McCarthy was one of the few people who had the courage to stand up to communism. Bobby also thought whatever excess there was in McCarthy had more to do with Roy Cohn, who was his nominal boss in the McCarthy office and somebody he despised from the beginning. So the way he justified the bad side of McCarthy was that was Roy Cohn. In terms of the sense that there were communists out there in the State Department and other parts of the U.S. government who could be undermining what we were trying to do, Bobby believed in that almost as fiercely as Joe McCarthy and the rest of his supporters.
And did he break with McCarthy because he became disillusioned with the cause?
He actually rejected McCarthy because he wasn't going anywhere, it was clear to him in terms of the office because of Roy Cohn, but it was never a break over the cause. It was never a break with McCarthy personally. It was a separation because he felt that he wasn't going anywhere there.
Joe McCarthy was an alcoholic, didn't live very long. He died in 1957, at the time Bobby Kennedy was still a young Senate staffer. Tell us about his funeral and Bobby.
Sure. So at the McCarthy funeral, this is in Appleton, Wisconsin, 19 senators in total, 7 congressmen, lots of other luminaries, all people who believed in McCarthy, flew in for the funeral. And they were, as soon as the plane landed, they were whisked away from Green Bay, the airport, to Appleton, where the funeral was going to be. And after everybody had gone, there was one small guy who walks off the plane at that point. He had sat there waiting to make sure everybody else was gone. He slipped on the exit ramp unnoticed. And that was Bobby Kennedy. And this was, to me, a reflection of the two sides of Bobby Kennedy. On the one hand, he was ultimately loyal to him as a person. He still believed in the cause, and he wasn't about to do what Jack Kennedy did, which was stay away because it wasn't politically popular to be there for a Democrat and for a Democrat who wanted liberal support. On the other hand, Bobby understood that what he was doing was controversial. So not only did he get off the plane quietly, at the church with the funeral, he sat in the choir by himself, basically hiding out a bit. At the graveside, he stood apart from everybody else who was there from official Washington. And after all of this was done, he asked the reporters who were on hand to basically not put in their stories that he had been there. And that was a day when reporters obliged in that kind of request. So this was Bobby the loyalist and Bobby the practical guy who understood the implications of what he had done by going to his pal Joe's funeral.
So what did this experience of serving for this, anti-communist witch hunter, do for Bobby Kennedy's career, his character, his worldview?
I think it did a couple things. One was the later Bobby Kennedy would have been even more critical of that early period, I think, than we're being right now. I think that he saw over time the excesses. He began to understand Joe McCarthy's victims, and it made him, like lots of things in his early life, more sensitive and more empathetic later on. But I also think, in practical terms, while most of what McCarthy did ended up being discredited, Bobby's investigation stood up in a way that nobody else's did. And while it was ultimately Democrats and Republicans who came together to censor Joe McCarthy, what many people don't realize is the report that both the Democrats and, uncharacteristically, the Republicans signed onto in the censure was a report that was prepared largely by Bobby Kennedy. So even as he stayed loyal to him as a friend, he understood the excesses, and he understood those excesses as being mainly the fault, as we've said, of Roy Cohn, not Joe McCarthy.
What was Bobby's relationship with Martin Luther King?
It was a relationship of two guys who were feeling one another out, I think who had a sense that they ought to like one another, but didn't like one another. Bobby Kennedy never quite trusted King. When J. Edgar Hoover was feeding Bobby all kinds of dirt on King having ties to communists, stuff that was patently untrue, Bobby Kennedy believed it enough that he was there as the protector of his brother Jack Kennedy, and he wanted to always keep a distance between Jack Kennedy and Martin Luther King. It wasn't just King's aides that Bobby worried about, it was King himself. And yet Martin Luther King had a sense that Bobby Kennedy was somebody who could be won over, that given time, that Bobby Kennedy would come around, and he proved right, even if he didn't necessarily live to see the dramatic turnaround.
Kennedy was Attorney General, which means he runs the Justice Department, which includes the FBI, whose director, J. Edgar Hoover, decides he wants to wiretap, run electronic surveillance on Martin Luther King. Did Kennedy know? How did he respond?
Kennedy initially responded by telling Hoover, "No, let's wait." And eventually, Hoover was the kind of guy who knew exactly how to play a guy like Bobby Kennedy. Bobby Kennedy was, as the Attorney General, the FBI director's boss. But Hoover had been around forever. He'd lived through lots of presidents and lots of attorneys general. And he knew that if he kept going back to Bobby with new pieces of dirt, Bobby would eventually say yes, and he did. He said the wiretap was okay.
And there were microphones in hotel rooms and extramarital affairs recorded. How did Bobby feel about all that?
He was distressed by it. He tried to bring back, save when he knew that Hoover was leaking some of the tapes about the dirt that they found out on Martin Luther King. Bobby Kennedy tried to get the reports withdrawn, tried to ensure that the leak stopped, but he couldn't do it. Hoover was a much better inside player, and Bobby Kennedy felt badly for two reasons. One is he realized he had gone too far and that he had sided with the wrong guy when it came to the choice between Hoover and King. And the other reason was, later politically, it was an embarrassment to him that he had had electronic surveillance on the civil rights icon Martin Luther King.
One thing you see when you look at Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General is that he was a man of action. He would act decisively. How did he grow and change? What do you think he learned from his experiences at the Justice Department?
So I think from his experiences at the Justice Department and throughout his life, he paid attention to what went right and wrong. He grew by actually seeing things up close. He took things to heart in a way that few politicians do. The notion of the kind of change that he did, which was a huge transformation from a cold warrior to America's most hot-blooded liberal, today we would dismiss maybe as a flip-flop because we're cynical. I think it was a really deep change, a real change, and as a sign of how dramatically he could change and how he learned, I want to just tell a quick story from when Bobby Kennedy was a senator from New York. He was elected in 1964, and early into his term, he did a trip from Washington with fellow senators to Jackson, Mississippi, where they were holding a hearing on hunger in America. And at that hearing, he heard testimony from a young civil rights lawyer named Marion Wright about just how horrible things were. And while the other senators flew back to Washington for the weekend, Bobby and one other senator, Joe Clark, the chairman of that subcommittee, insisted that they wanted to see what she had been describing. And they went to an area called the Mississippi Delta. And they were shown around a bunch of poor shacks where people were living 15 to a shack. And Bobby Kennedy, in one of these shacks, when he thought nobody else was around and watching, Bobby Kennedy went into the home where an infant was sitting in a bed up on bricks. This was people living in dire poverty. Bobby Kennedy saw a toddler on the floor who was playing around with his cornmeal, and there were flies overhead, and it was a really moving scene. And he looked at this young boy. He got down in his dress suit on the floor with this boy, and he spent 10 or 15 minutes trying to make some sort of contact. The boy was clearly, he had a bloated stomach from the poverty and from the malnutrition. He was not focusing on Bobby. And he went home after that hearing and did two things that I think very few senators would have done. One is he met with the Secretary of Agriculture, and he insisted that this guy, Orville Freeman, check out what was going on with his food programs, that you had to have in those days a certain amount of money to be able to buy food stamps. And Bobby said that what he had seen in the Delta convinced him that there were Americans who had absolutely no income and were starving. Freeman agreed to send his aide and Bobby's aide back to Mississippi, and that if they found that what Bobby said was true, they would change the rules of the anti-poverty program. They found that it was true, and they changed the rules. So one thing is he went back and he got a very concrete effect from what he had seen. The other was he went home to Hickory Hill and to his family's estate in McLean, Virginia. And he sat down at the Sunday dinner table with his kids, and he said, "I have just seen something so horrific that I want you to understand that we have all that we need to eat. We live an extraordinarily privileged life. Not only are people starving in places like Mississippi, but you've got a responsibility in your life to do something about it the same way I do." And his kids say if there's nothing else they ever remembered about his lecturing them, it was the impassioned way he came back and made them understand that they had to see what he had seen in Mississippi and understand it.
1968 was a year unlike any other. President Lyndon Johnson announced on television he would not be running for re-election. He dropped out of the race. 4 days later, Martin Luther King is assassinated in Memphis. And Bobby Kennedy was campaigning in Indiana at the time. And we have a little bit of the speech that he made that night. You want to just set this up for us? Tell us what the circumstance was.
Sure. So Bobby gets off a plane in Indianapolis and is told that Martin Luther King has been shot. The mayor of Indianapolis, a guy who went on to become a U.S. senator named Richard Lugar, says to Bobby, "You will not go into the inner city to the rally. You will not go there because your safety will be jeopardized and the safety of the city will be jeopardized." Bobby Kennedy says, "You're not going to tell me where to go and not to go." He goes into the inner city. He tells people who are at this rally for the first time, many of them, that Martin Luther King has been shot, and by then he had been killed. And Bobby Kennedy, that was the first time since Jack had been assassinated that he talked about the pain of having somebody that you loved die. He had a credibility that no white politician would have had. And in just about every big city in America, the night that Martin Luther King was killed, there were race riots. There was no race riot in Indianapolis, and I think that was because of Bobby Kennedy.
All right, let's listen to a bit of this. This is an edited version, I will tell you, because the speech is too long, but this is Bobby Kennedy speaking to a crowd in Indianapolis on the night that Martin Luther King was assassinated.
Ladies and gentlemen, I'm only going to talk to you just for a minute or so this evening because I have some very sad news for all of you. Could you lower those signs, please? I have some very sad news for all of you, and I think sad news for all of our fellow citizens and people who love peace all over the world. And that is that Martin Luther King was shot and was killed tonight in Memphis, Tennessee. for those of you who are black and are tempted to be filled with hatred and mistrust of the injustice of such an act against all white people, I would only say that I can also feel in my own heart the same kind of feeling. I had a member of my family killed, but he was killed by a white man. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another, and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country. So I ask you tonight to return home, to say a prayer for the family, Martin Luther King, yeah, it's true, but more importantly, to say a prayer for our own country, which all of us love, a prayer for understanding and that compassion that of which I spoke.
And that was Robert Kennedy speaking in 1968 to a crowd in Indianapolis right after the assassination of Martin Luther King. Bobby Kennedy is assassinated after winning the California primary at the Ambassador Hotel. There was no Secret Service protection then. It's a horrific tragedy. Are there any lingering questions about whether his assassin, Sirhan Sirhan, acted alone?
There are almost as many questions about what happened with Bobby Kennedy's assassination as there are about Jack's, and I don't pretend to be able to clear those up. All I can say is that I found nothing that convinced me that there was a conspiracy that had been laid out in convincing enough terms that I could believe it.
Larry Tye, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Thanks for having me on.
Larry Tye's latest book is Bobby Kennedy, The Making of a Liberal Icon. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Tuesday. New Orleans pianist, singer, songwriter, arranger, and producer Alan Toussaint died suddenly last November at age 77, the month before he completed recording the second album he made with producer Joe Henry. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he likes the sequel better than the original.
Alan Toussaint, New Orleansifying Fats Waller's Viper's Drag, from the pianist's final album, American Tunes. It's a belated sequel to The Bright Mississippi, also produced by Joe Henry, which placed Toussaint among musicians from way outside his circle. On that one, the lack of a New Orleans drummer seemed to tie one hand behind Toussaint's back, and a Dixielandy band made some hip musicians sound corny. The second pass at the concept has its bumps, but works better. Guests like Bill Frisell and Charles Lloyd are less intrusive, and returning Los Angeles drummer Jay Belrose and bassist David Pilch sound more at ease. Earl Hines' tune Rosetta from Alan Toussaint's American Tunes. As on The Bright Mississippi, the repertoire is meant to connect the New Orleans great with broader American traditions. He could be charming and funny, and so could Fats Waller, so why not do Viper's Drag? There are tunes by fellow pianists Billy Strayhorn and Bill Evans, a couple of Professor Longhair Crescent City standards, and an 1850s dance by Louis Moreau Gottschalk, the New Orleans composer who brought Cuban syncopations to American sheet music. Harp and cello sweetening and the second piano part are by arranger Van Dyke Parks. He also joins the leader on a two-piano version of the only Toussaint standard on the program. One highlight of Alan Toussaint's late-period songbook concerts, in which he warmly thanked stars who made his songs hits, was the way he reclaimed his mysterioso tune Southern Nights from the memory of Glen Campbell's polka version. The blur of two pianos is like an evening mist descending over the melody. On Alan Toussaint's final album, Carolina Chocolate Drop Rhiannon Giddens drops by to sing Duke Ellington's Rocks in My Bed and Come Sunday. Alan Toussaint's only vocal is on Paul Simon's American Tune, where producer Joe Henry does something I'd never have seen coming. He makes Toussaint sound like 70s crooner Cat Stevens.
Oh, but I'm all right. I'm all right. I'm just weary to my bones. Still, you don't expect to be bright and bon vivant so far away from home. So far away from home.
On his valedictory album, American Tunes, Alan Toussaint also plays four pieces solo, so we can better appreciate his touch and timing at the keys and how deeply steeped he was in the rolling New Orleans piano tradition epitomized by Professor Longhair. The record's a fond last look at a composer and pianist who helped refine classic New Orleans pop and rhythm and blues and then brought them into the modern era. We miss him already.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Point of Departure and Tone Audio and is the author of Why Jazz. He reviewed American Tunes, the final album by the New Orleans pianist Alan Toussaint, who died last November. We're going to talk about new ways of understanding and treating addiction. Our next guest, Maya Salovitz, is the author of a new book that examines scientific, behavioral, and medical research about addiction. She says the methods of treatment and punishment haven't caught up with the research. Salovitz is a journalist who has been covering addiction and drug-related issues for nearly 30 years. She writes a column for Vice and has been a health reporter and columnist for Time magazine. She was addicted to cocaine and heroin from the ages of 17 to 23. Her new book about addiction is called Unbroken Brain. She spoke with Terry last Thursday.
Maya Salovitz, welcome to Fresh Air. So you see addiction as a coping behavior. For coping with what?
It could be anything, and this is why it gets so complicated. Some people might be using it because the world is too intense and too much and they feel overloaded. Some people might feel just the opposite. They might feel that nothing means anything, nothing's stimulating, nothing's exciting. So there's so many different individual reasons why people become addicted that it's really important. You know, in the past, everybody has just said, all addiction is this and all addiction is that. And, you know, we would never say that about any other kind of disorder. In the autism world, there's a saying that if you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. And we need to import that into the addiction world rather than assuming that I, because I have had an addiction, can speak for everybody with addiction.
But you do refer to longitudinal studies that have looked at who's at risk for addiction. And those studies, you say, have found three major pathways. Do you want to describe what those are?
Sure. So there is one pathway where children are oversensitive and overstimulated and very anxious and really kind of nervous. And these kids are looking for a way to calm down and a way to feel safe and a way to connect. There is another pathway where people are understimulated and they feel almost like nothing feels like anything. They feel very disconnected or very numb. And those kids are looking for excitement and stimulation and to feel more. And then the third path, which is kind of the most interesting, is where you sort of swing back and forth between the two. Sometimes you're understimulated, sometimes you're overstimulated, but all three of them have in common that there is a dysregulation of the ability to control emotion and sensation.
So how old were you when you first started using? And you were using heroin and cocaine.
Yes. I first started using cocaine when I was 17. I was in high school. I had a boyfriend who was selling it, and his brother actually sold to Jerry Garcia, which is how my first drug experience with cocaine happened to be with Jerry Garcia backstage or at his hotel after a Grateful Dead concert.
So you were 17 the first time you snorted coke. Had you already used heroin?
No. I had been, you know, your sort of little deadhead. I had discovered that I was always a kid who had some kind of obsessive interest. And so this ranged from opera to science fiction to I wanted to be a symphony conductor for a while. These interests were not generally of interest to other kids. Drugs, however, were an interest that a lot of my peers shared. And so when I became involved in drugs, I became able to socialize a lot better. The first thing I did was marijuana and hash and LSD. And I have to say, I learned a lot from that. One of the weird things about my experience was when I had a psychedelic experience with LSD, I learned that, wow, other people have vastly different perspectives. And, you know, it's not such a big deal to be nice to people. You can just do what people want without rebelling so much. You can, you know, if your mom wants you to do the dishes, you can just do them. So unlike many kids who begin experimenting with drugs in order to rebel from their parents, I actually became a much more manageable kid after using drugs, which is very odd.
You were arrested when you were 23? Do I have that right?
No, I was arrested when I was 20.
Okay. You were caught with 2.5 kilos of cocaine, most of which, you say, belonged to your boyfriend's supplier. You were supposed to get a mandatory minimum sentence of 15 years on a 1986 charge, but you managed to not serve any time. How did that work out?
Well, I have to say that being white and being female and being a person who was at an Ivy League school and being privileged in many other ways had an enormous amount to do with why I was not incarcerated and why I'm not in prison now. I think our laws are completely and utterly racist. They were founded in racism and they are enforced in a thoroughly biased manner. I was extraordinarily lucky. And what happened to me was, when I was arrested, I weighed about 85 pounds. I had tracks up and down my arm. I looked green and gray, and I had pulled out my hair because I sometimes did that on coke. It was this horrible bleach blonde. I just looked like I was dying. And it was about a year between the arrest and my indictment. And during that year, after getting bailed out, I just got worse. and I got sicker and sicker, and I was shooting up dozens of times a day, and I knew that I had to stop, and I couldn't stop. And it was awful. And one day, I found myself beginning to run out of money. I found myself begging a guy that I really didn't like for heroin. And even though I was in the room with him and his girlfriend and my boyfriend, I thought about, well, maybe I could seduce him to get the drugs. And when I had that thought, something in me changed. I just realized all my excuses for saying I wasn't really addicted went away. And I just knew that I needed help. So that day, I stayed sick. I didn't get heroin. The next morning, I had a court date. I went to court looking as horrible as I looked. I told the judge, I know I need help. I got into treatment. And then about 4 months later, I came back for another court date, and I was tan and fat and still horribly blonde, but there was life in my eyes again. I looked like a person who had a chance. The physical transformation was so extreme that the judge and everybody else was just like, this doesn't look like the same person. And so she said to my lawyer, you know, I think she has a chance. If she stays in recovery, I'd like to try to, you know, keep her out of prison. But she's got to do something about that hair color because it looks awful. And I'm now a redhead.
So at some point, you knew that you had a problem. You knew that you were addicted. You knew you'd probably die if you didn't straighten yourself out. And you knew you had to stop, and you stopped. And that kept you out of serving a minimum of 15 years in prison. Some people don't seem to reach that point of knowing that they're addicted, they have a problem, and they need to stop to save themselves. And that's where things like tough love and interventions come in. And it's also sometimes where like criminal interventions come in. I mean, there are people who do kick in jail and go on to, you know, get sober and eventually get out of jail and live a sober life.
Well, let me say something here about this notion of tough love and hitting bottom.
Mm-hmm.
It was 2 years after I got arrested that I got into treatment. After I got arrested, I got worse and worse. I didn't hit bottom when I had the insight that allowed me to seek help. What I got at that point was some kind of hope that I could change. And we have this idea that if we just are cruel enough and mean enough and tough enough to people with addiction, that they will suddenly wake up and stop. And that is not the case. Addiction is actually defined by the DSM and by the National Institute on Drug Abuse as compulsive behavior that continues despite negative consequences. That's the definition of addiction. So therefore, if punishment, which is just another word for negative consequences, worked to fight addiction, addiction actually wouldn't exist. And so we just have this thing so wrong. Addiction is a problem with learning from punishment, and we expect punishment to fix it. There's something deeply wrong with that.
You're relieved that your parents did not practice tough love. Do you often think about what would have happened to you if they had practiced tough love?
Yes, I do. In tough love programs where kids in the 80s and 90s, and unfortunately still today, were sent, the treatment involves public humiliation, complete lack of privacy, sleep deprivation, intense emotional attacks, and all kinds of things that would have been utter torture. And I don't know how I would have survived something like that. I don't know how I would have survived just being cut off and left in the street. I really don't know. And we do know from looking at the data that if you are kind and supportive and empathetic, if you do things like provide clean needles, provide opportunities for people to reverse overdose, provide safe injecting spaces, those things do not prolong addiction. And if tough love was the answer, and the idea was that you shouldn't enable addiction, if that theory was correct, those things should all prolong addiction, and the exact opposite is true. When you go into a needle exchange, one of the most amazing things is people are just treated with dignity and respect. And when you're an active drug user, when you are injecting, everybody crosses the street to avoid you. And here, you're just seen as a person who deserves to live, and you deserve a chance. And it's that that gives people hope, and it's that that shortens the period of addiction. And we just have it so backwards in so many different ways. But what has been amazing to see is the growth of these harm reduction and, you know, love approaches that are not tough, that are not harsh, that treat people with addiction like human beings. And surprisingly, when you treat people well, they tend to treat themselves better.
So what do you think of interventions? And interventions are usually organized by family or friends who have watched their loved one just really deteriorate mentally, physically, and who won't recognize that they have a problem, that they're an addict, that they need help. And they feel that the only way to save the person's life and the only way to prevent them from further hurting the lives of the people who love them is to force them to get help through an intervention.
Well, I can tell you that there's a method that is twice as effective as intervention that has been shown in multiple studies to be twice as effective as that, that doesn't do that confrontation, that doesn't threaten the person with being thrown out of the family, that doesn't have the potential risk that, you know, Kurt Cobain shot himself after an intervention. Interventions often backfire. A lot of families don't want to go through with interventions because they feel like they're being cruel, and often they are being cruel. So what is this alternative approach? It's called Community Reinforcement and Family Therapy. The acronym is CRAFT. And in this approach, what happens is parents and other loved ones are taught ways of helping the person with addiction see for themselves why change is a good idea. And this is done through offering hope, through not rejecting the person. Now, obviously, if you have somebody who is addicted and is doing things like putting younger children at risk, stealing from you, being violent, any of these things, that's not acceptable, and you may need to cut them out of your life. The thing is, you can't assume that cutting them out of your life is going to help them. You need to help yourself first, you know, just like putting on the mask on the airplane. But you have to also realize that with addiction, and particularly addiction combined with mental illness, putting somebody on the street is not going to be helpful to them. Again, there are times when it may be necessary, but mostly people find that if you help people develop their own motivation for recovery, they are much more likely to get into recovery and stay in recovery if you do it that way than if you do the big confrontational intervention.
So, you know, a lot of people have been able to give up their addiction, whether it's drugs or alcohol, with the help of 12-step programs. And I think it's fair to say a 12-step program helped you, although there are things that you found were not helpful within the program. But you say, like, just relying on 12-step programs is the equivalent of saying to somebody who has cancer, we're not going to give you any drugs, but here's a self-help group. It's really going to help you.
I think the 12-step programs are fabulous self-help. I think they can be absolutely wonderful as support groups. My issue with 12-step programs is that 80% of addiction treatment in this country consists primarily of indoctrinating people into 12-step programs. And no other medical care in the United States is like that. We don't tell people with cancer that you must learn to surrender to a higher power, to pray, to confess to your sins, to make restitution. If you went to a doctor for cancer and you were told that, you would think that you had found a quack. But in addiction, if you go to a treatment center, you will be told this is the only way and the alternative is jails, institutions, or death. So what I think is that we need to have within professional treatment, no 12-step content. That doesn't mean that professional treatment can't refer people to AA as a support group. But professional treatment should consist of things that you cannot get for free elsewhere. So it should consist of cognitive behavioral therapy or motivational enhancement therapy or any of a number of different talk therapies that help people with addiction. I am not saying if 12-step programs work for you, you should quit them and do something else. I am saying that your oncologist is not your breast cancer support group.
But I mean, 12-step programs do help so many people.
The data shows that cognitive behavioral and motivational enhancement therapy are equally effective, and they have none of the issues around surrendering to a higher power or prayer or confession. I think that one of the problems with the primary 12-step approach that we've seen in addiction treatment is that because the 12 steps involve moral issues, it makes people think that addiction is a sin and not a disease. The only treatment in medicine that involves prayer, restitution, and confession is for addiction. That fact makes people think that addiction is a sin rather than a medical problem. I think that if we want to destigmatize addiction, we need to get the 12 steps out of professional treatment and put them where they belong as self-help. And I think that if we also want to destigmatize addiction, we can't simultaneously criminalize drug possession, because criminalization, the whole point of it, is to stigmatize you.
Maya Salovitz, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Maya Salovitz is a journalist who's covered addiction for 30 years. Her latest book is Unbroken Brain. She spoke with Terry last Thursday. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Thea Challoner. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.